podcast, an interview program on authors, academics, and intellectuals. Also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiyah. Of what use is philosophy? Does it belong in our daily lives? Can it aid in the big decisions of our day? To go to war, to raise taxes or lower them, to assure everyone healthcare, education, even happiness? Can it help us decide which job to take, which man to date? Or instead, is it merely a plaything of academics who like to puzzle over the concepts of truth, reality, and virtue? Or can it help us actually become better people? Simon Blackburn, an esteemed professor of philosophy at Trinity College at the University of Cambridge, may just be the man to answer these questions. Simon, welcome to ThoughtCast.
Thank you very much, Jenny.
You've just come out with a new book called Truth, A Guide. It's written for the layman in accessible prose, and actually you've written several popular books on philosophy, notably Think and Being Good, two bestsellers. Simon, do we really need more philosophy in our lives?
Well, need is a strong word. I think our lives benefit from it. I think that reflection is not the privilege of the educated elite. I think we all reflect. We may do it sort of in a fairly confused way. We may do it without very much coming out of it. But I think it's a process we can't avoid. We're self-conscious animals, reflective animals, and my books are there to help that process along. They're not designed to tell you any answers. They're designed to help you work out the answers for yourself.
Clearly, you want to release philosophy from the confines of the academy. What can it do for us? Can it halt wars?
Well, I certainly think it can help. I mean, the ancient Greeks, who we always look back to, of course, in philosophy, believed that philosophy was there to enable you to live the good life. And although that ambition might be slightly difficult to achieve, I think it can help, and therefore it can help you substitute cooperation for competition, substitute talk for aggression, and it could, in principle, help you stop wars, I think. For example, the knee-jerk reaction to go all out for a war on terror after 9/11 may not have been the most intelligent response to Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. There may have been other much more intelligent responses, such as trying to understand the motivations that lead to that kind of terrorism and alter the world so that they no longer get a purchase or get a popular purchase across the Islamic world. Now, I'm not saying I know how to do that or even that it was possible, but it was certainly an avenue worth exploring, and I think it's the avenue that philosophy would have taken us down rather than the knee-jerk reaction of revenge or going to war.
Those are instincts. Revenge, fear, nationalistic pride.
Right.
How does one insert philosophy before those feelings take over?
Right. That's a very good question. And the Stoics were the team, the school of philosophers who had the most interest in that question. They thought that if you walk down a forest path, for example, and you hear a crackling in the undergrowth, and the thought that it might be a bear comes into your mind, then there would be a feeling, but that wasn't yet the emotion of fear. The emotion of fear would only take over when you let it. So there's an opportunity to insert some thought and potentially to make a better reaction to the situation. Now, I think they were idealistic about this, but I think certainly in public events, there is the moment when emotions are taking over, when everybody's getting up in Congress or wherever it is and saying, let's go to war, where the philosopher can insert a still small voice, and it may be it should be a voice for peace, almost always. And so I think in principle, yes, there's always the opportunity for reflective care and caution in how we react to events.
Do we have a philosopher at the moment who is in a position to stand up while the Congress is debating and be heard?
Very few. I mean, the only major public intellectuals in America, you can probably count on the fingers of one hand. And the only, I think, philosopher who would count amongst them is probably Noam Chomsky, if we call him a philosopher, because half a linguist as much as a philosopher. I think that's partly accident. It's partly the dynamics of democracy. It's easier for a statesman or a politician, let's say, to be seen to be listening to the people celebrities, people who've got the year of the people, and they'll get more credit in the eyes of their electorate if they go the popular route, rather than if they listen to somebody writing in the New York Times or the New York Review of Books, God help us. So I think that's the dynamic that keeps intellectuals pretty much under the rug. And so actually bringing the voice of philosophy out into the public is a very difficult thing to do.
Simon, these ideas you're able to express in these, quote, more popular books of philosophy have been very well received.
Thanks.
But in addition, you've also written some more, in quotes, serious works, notably Spreading the Word, a textbook, Essays on Quasi-Realism, and Ruling Passions, a Theory of Practical Reasoning. Whose side are you on, the closed circle of academics or the rest of us?
I don't make a sharp distinction, Jenny. I don't like thinking of my more popular books as popularizations. That, of course, is a dirty word in academe, and I'm sure there are people out there saying, oh, Blackburn's sold out, he's a mere popularizer, and so on. I resist that. The image I like to use is I think of myself as bringing people to philosophy. I don't think of myself as diluting philosophy for people. I think there's as much, in a way, there's as much hard philosophy in a little book like Think or Being Good as there is in Spreading the Word. I think the difference is I do presuppose some knowledge in Spreading the Word, whereas I try and lead you in from scratch in the other books. But the place you might get to is not so very different.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm talking with the Cambridge University philosopher Simon Blackburn about the role of philosophy in public life. Simon, we live, at least we think we live, in a democracy.
Right.
But Plato preferred the idea of the philosopher king.
Yes.
A wise man capable of rising above his own interests to rule on behalf of the people.
Right.
I actually spoke with the Princeton philosopher Anthony Appiah about this concept.
Right.
And like you, he thinks that some philosophies are dangerous. If you give a philosopher the power to act in the real world, bad things can happen. He mentioned Pol Pot.
Yeah, sure. No, I think that's right. I mean, ideas are dangerous. I don't think I put it by saying philosophers are dangerous, especially. I think probably as armed. But they are armed, and they're armed for bear, because ideas are loaded for bear. Basically, people, they organize themselves around ideas. The idea of who gets what, of whether you should be armed or not, whether these immigrants should be fed or not, how you distribute medical resources, how you tax people, what does the state deserve from people in return for what it gives them, and so on. All those are ideas. And if you disagree about those ideas, it may become very dangerous. Or if you've got the wrong ideas, it may become catastrophic.
And in many ways, I do think that the question is valid about philosophy. In what way can it be appropriated?
Right.
For good or for ill?
Right, right. Well, that's a very good question, Jenny. I dread to think, but it's probably true, that, you know, given the mixed and spotty creature that we are, that reflection has as good a chance of going wrong, and when it goes wrong, things go wrong with it, as anything else. You only have to think of Marxism, for example, which is a philosopher's take on society. A very intelligent take on society, but unfortunately dead wrong. And look at what it cost us. Nazism, everybody's favorite example of the world gone wrong, is the offshoot of German Romanticism. You couldn't have had Hitler without the Romantic movement and the nostalgia for a lost past, and therefore the looking for a scapegoat for victims who were responsible for our decline and fall. All those ideas are implicit in German Romanticism. And you know, in its beginning, that must have seemed the most harmless set of reflections and set of attitudes to life.
Almost
aesthetic, just the poet in the wilderness and the nature and beautiful trees and so on. But it just requires a tincture of things going wrong, and you get all hell breaking loose, literally. So I don't think anyone should make an apology for spending a life bothered about ideas. I think they're the most dangerous things we have, more dangerous than guns, because the ideas determine who's got the guns.
What do you think about the ideas of the Bush administration?
Oh dear, well, that's not my area of expertise, and you're liable to get a great torrent of prejudice. I think the Bush administration came closest to philosophy when, as is reported, a spokesman for the White House expressed contempt for the reality-based community. I mean, that was a nightmarish thing to say, because it did imply that the White House is fairly content to exist in the kind of virtual reality which it has the power to create for itself by control of the media, by control of the information the Pentagon gives out, by control of all our sources of knowledge of the effects of what the White House is up to. The White House can successfully present itself as having some effects or other in the world when the reality is quite different. And the only people who know it's quite different are the people who are dead in other countries.
That doesn't sound like democracy.
Well, democracy has got its Achilles heels. It's a word that attracts nothing but waving flags and patriotism. But unfortunately, the restless spirit of philosophical inquiry isn't quite so kind to democracy, because, first of all, if you imagine a pure one-man, one-vote democracy, even in its ideal form, it's got to be hedged with constitutional guarantees to stop it turning into tyranny of the majority, whereby you've got different coloured hair from the majority, you get executed, or whatever it is. And the mere fact of one-man, one-vote doesn't guarantee any of that. I mean, I think people don't understand what an extraordinarily wonderful and complex historical growth the American Constitution was. And it was written by people who'd studied philosophers. Some of them were philosophers. People like Franklin, Jefferson, Adams. John Locke was the principal influence on the American Constitution.
But isn't the Constitution really philosophy gone pragmatic?
Yes, it's philosophy gone into practice. It was a philosophy of politics, a philosophy of how the polis, the political body, should best hang together. You mentioned Platonism a bit ago, the idea of the philosopher king. I mean, arguably, Plato went wrong because he was obsessed in the Republic by the question, who's to rule? And interestingly, the sea change that had to be effected by particularly Locke, I think, was to change the question. The question was not to be who's to rule, but how's the ruling to be carried out, and how's it to be controlled? And it turned out that a constitutional democracy didn't need philosopher kings in order to function pretty well. It needed an informed and intelligent body of representatives chosen by the people, and with sufficient checks and balances, which the Constitution attempted to provide, that should work.
You mentioned earlier that you've spent quite a bit of time in the U.S. as a resident alien. You lived here actually for a decade in the 90s when you taught philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So obviously you know us very well. How would you rate the philosophical health of the current climate here in the United States?
Well, if we were talking simply about the state of philosophy in your universities, it's very, very good. Undoubtedly the powerhouse of Anglo-American philosophy is over here in the best universities in the United States. If it's a question of the state of mind of everybody else, or at least of the demos, the people, then I worry about it much more. I think America, and for that matter England, unfortunately, are aggressive countries. They're countries in which unbridled aggression is not uncommon. I think it's thought that an American child watches something like 18,000 murders on TV before they're grown up.
But no sex.
But no sex. So that's three murders a day, I suppose, is the calculation. But no sex. And I know a lot of parents, concerned parents, sensible parents, worry about that. And I'd worry about it.
The lack of sex.
Especially the lack of sex. Yes. Well, I wrote a book on lust, so I've got to stick up for that. But, of course, the omnipresence of violence. And I think that does engender a cowboy mentality, that there's no problem too big that you can't solve it with a gun. And I think that's a very, it's self-evidently dangerous. And also, it's self-evidently impoverishing. I mean, if you think of the proportion of the national wealth that goes on so-called defense, which really means aggression, of course, then it's frightening, absolutely frightening.
You're listening to Thoughtcast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm talking with the Cambridge University philosopher Simon Blackburn, the author of several popular works on philosophy, including Think and Being Good. Simon, your new book, called Truth, A Guide, examines the conflict between two different philosophical approaches. On one hand are the traditionalists, who insist on standards and believe in objective, absolute truths. And on the other, you have the relativists, multiculturalists, and postmodernists, for whom anything goes. You write that there's something diabolical about relativism. Why?
Yes, well, that was put in the mouths of the absolutists, that it's feared as diabolical. Yes, I mean, the postmodernists and relativists and people like that do excite the wrath of particularly conservative commentators, I think. They see them as subversive, as somehow not standing up for the American way and all the rest of it. So I think it is a battleground which attracts emotional pressure. Unfortunately, just as my book was in press, the new Pope, Cardinal Ratzinger, launched on the eve of his being elected. It was a kind of stump speech, a swinging attack on the relativism that saps people's moral fibre in the modern world. And the Roman Catholic Church was going to be the bulwark against it, of course. So I think people who purport to know the truth, either rightly or wrongly, and who think of themselves as having right on their side, are of course extremely upset when the stance of authority is subverted. And what relativism basically does is it subverts authority. It says, well, that's your opinion, but here's mine. Or who's to say, you know, and refuses to listen to your credentials as being worth more than the paper they're written on. And of course, if you regard yourself as the vicar of Christ and the voice of God on earth, you don't like people saying, well, you know, that's just your will to power. And all I'm hearing is dogma and an attempt to take over the lives of the poor and of women and so on. So, of course, you've got war. You've got an antagonism here. And my book's about the nature of that antagonism.
Isn't it true, though, that in terms of reality, rather than theory, a lot of the relativists and deconstructionists are actually saying not that anything goes, but that you're wrong and we're right?
Well, they're bound to run close to a paradox, which Socrates tries to use to upset the relativists way back in the dialogue called the Theaetetus. Does the relativist put forward his position as authoritative, as true, and in which case isn't he undermining his own philosophy by that very act? How is he purporting to do without authority while at the same time claiming it for the position that we ought to try to do without authority?
It's difficult in a way to follow your point of view in this book, Truth, A Guide, which of course we all try to do.
Yes.
What does he really think?
Yes.
But in Being Good, you write about how those in power who benefit from the status quo try to fend off those who ask too many embarrassing questions, notably philosophers who engage in critical thinking. And you write, quote, The Western white male may flourish because of the inferior economic or social status of people who are not Western or white or male. Insofar as we are like that, we will not want the lid to be lifted. This positions philosophy as a weapon for the underprivileged to wield against the old boys' club, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. And that's quite deliberate, and I believe that, yeah. I think that a large part of the value, you know, we started talking about the value of philosophy, and a large part of the value of philosophy has always been this reflective, critical drip, as it were, which as soon as it sees a dogma or, you know, asks for its, or an asymmetry of power and authority, asks for its basis and insists on finding a basis that can stand up to critical scrutiny. That's what the Athenian democracy killed Socrates for. That's why he was executed. He was the first martyr of the liberal inquiring mind, at least the first one we know about.
Can't we look at this battle between absolutism and relativism really as a battle of the old guard versus the new? The old guard being those who protect the institutions of philosophy that they have created, and the new being those who, again, have modes of inquiry that challenge it.
Yes, to some extent I think that's true, and it's very interesting that an absolutist view of truth tends to associate in, I think, not just the public mind, but in the dynamic in the literature, with conservatism and with possibly the status quo, with the old regime, whatever it may be. And of course, the old regime could be a left-wing regime. There's nothing more absolutist and dogmatically sort of fixed than the philosophy of the Soviet Union in its heyday. So it's not actually left versus right. It's more entrenched versus subversive, or old regime versus new revolutionaries.
You're listening to Simon Blackburn, the Cambridge University philosopher and author of the book Truth, A Guide. And this is ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia. Simon, I sense that you are both an absolutist and a revolutionary at times.
Yes.
And I have an example for you.
Oh, dear.
In your book, Lust, written for a series on the seven deadly sins, published by Oxford University Press and the New York Public Library, you shoot down the ages-old belief that while men are by nature promiscuous, women are naturally modest and monogamous.
That's right. That's a patriarchal story in which I don't believe.
That is where I see the revolutionary
yes,
in you.
Yes, that's right.
You very clearly state that this is an abuse of power in which the powerful men have managed to school women in sexual shame and thereby control them. You quote, I think a rather good friend of yours, I think you're very close with the 18th century philosopher David Hume.
Oh, yes.
He writes, those who have an interest in the fidelity of women naturally disapprove of their infidelity and all the approaches to it. Education takes possession of the ductile minds of the fair sex in their infancy.
Mm. Yes, that's right. I think Hume was exactly right about that there is a motive, especially for men, to guard the chastity of their women. I think that's visible in societies almost worldwide. As Hume remarks, it's because of the trivial anatomical difference that women always know who their own children are and men don't.
Not so trivial.
Not so trivial, no. And the rest follows from that. But that's a cultural explanation of it, not an educational explanation. Well, of course, I ought to say that although the book Lust was enjoying itself in that chapter, I didn't argue for a radical liberation movement. It says, therefore, as a result of all this, women shouldn't be educated in that way. I think that's a different matter because, of course, the fact that they are educated that way may, you know, that may too have evolved over centuries as the best way of the sexes cooperating. It may have needed that to stop men being even worse than they are in some way or another. Hmm. So So the consequences of a change there might be a little bit more radical than I thought of or was prepared to go into. But I was saying, look, let's see this for what it is, which is at least a piece of education, which is a piece of indoctrination, if you prefer it, which is imposed on women largely in the interests of men.
But you just said, let's not stop this indoctrination.
Well, I think that would be another argument. I suspect that that's I think we should certainly lighten it up a bit. But whether we should stop it altogether might be a subtle matter.
To me, if I may say, that sounds perhaps somewhat self-serving.
Well, I have to be careful, don't I? Yes.
In fact, again, you are somewhat difficult to pin down in truth,
right.
A guide. You present yourself as a traditionalist, and you are clearly no fan of identity politics.
Right.
And yet, you seem to be able to side with both points of view rather admirably as you go through the book.
Thank you for the word admirably. I did set out to do justice to both sides, because I find, and I do find in myself, a sympathy with both sides. I can be absolutist. I think, for example, when it comes to something like the authority of science, I am absolutist. On the other hand, I do appreciate the relativist point. One of my favorite quotations that I use in the book is one that the talkative royal butler, Princess Diana's butler, Paul Burrell, who spilt his memoirs to the press, he's supposed to have said of a conversation with Her Majesty the Queen that the Queen said, there are dark forces at work of which we know nothing. And that is a kind of relativist slogan, that when it comes to the way your mind is shaped, the way you make up your mind, the way the forces that determine the way you come to opinion and judgment, there are dark forces at work of which you know nothing. A moment ago, you see, the dark force at work might have been something self-serving, which I was sublimely unconscious until you raised the possibility. And that's always going to be, the relativist is always going to insist that there are things like that around. And I think we do well very often to listen. You know, we have to beware of the sources of judgment. The wells may be much less pure than we like to think.
Well, Simon, thank you for your thoughts, and thank you for being a guest on ThoughtCast.
My pleasure, Jenny. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You've been listening to Simon Blackburn, the Cambridge philosopher and author of Truth, A Guide. And this is ThoughtCast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. We welcome your thoughts on truth, philosophy, relativism. Just go to the site and click on the link for comments. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.